Secretary of State. The main challenge which faced the Jefferson administration was navigating between the two great empires of Britain and France, which were almost constantly at war. The first great triumph was the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, made possible when Napoleon realized he could not defend that vast territory, and it was to France's advantage that Britain not seize it. Madison and President Jefferson reversed party policy to negotiate for the purchase and then win congressional approval. Madison tried to maintain neutrality between Britain and France, but at the same time insisted on the legal rights of the U.S. under international law. Neither London nor Paris showed much respect, however. Madison and Jefferson decided on an embargo to punish Britain and France, forbidding Americans to trade with any foreign nation. The embargo failed as foreign policy, and instead caused massive hardships in the southern seaboard, which depended on foreign trade. During his term as Secretary of State, he was a party to the Supreme Court case Marbury v. Madison, in which the doctrine of judicial review was asserted by the High Court. The party's congressional caucus chose presidential candidates, and Madison was selected in the election of 1808, easily defeating Charles Catesworth Pinckney, riding on the coattails of Jefferson's popularity. Congress repealed the failed embargo as Madison took office. The Bank of the United States. The 20-year charter of the First Bank of the United States was scheduled to expire in 1811, the second year of Madison's administration. Madison failed to block the bank in 1791 and waited for its charter to expire. Secretary of Treasury Gallatin wanted the bank rechartered, and when the War of 1812 broke out, he discovered how difficult it was to finance the war without the bank. Gallatin's successor as Treasury Secretary, Alexander J. Dallas, proposed a replacement in 1814, but Madison vetoed the bill in 1815. By late 1815, however, Madison asked Congress for a new bank, which had strong support from the younger nationalistic Republicans, such as John C. Calhoun and Henry Clay, as well as Federalist Daniel Webster. Madison signed it into law in 1816 and appointed William Jones as its president. War of 1812. British insults continued, especially the practice of using the Royal Navy to intercept unarmed American merchant ships and impress, conscript, all sailors who might be British subjects for service in the British Army. Madison's protests were ignored, so he helped stir up public opinion in the West and South for war. One argument was that an American invasion of Canada would be easy and would provide a good bargaining chip. Madison carefully prepared public opinion for what everyone at the time called Mr. Madison's War. But much less time and money was spent building up the army, navy, forts, and state militias. After he convinced Congress to declare war, Madison was re-elected president over DeWitt Clinton, by a smaller margin than in 1808. See or hear the U.S. presidential election of 1812. Some historians in 2006 ranked Madison's failure to avoid war as the sixth worst presidential mistake ever made. In the ensuing War of 1812, the British Canadians and First Nations allies won numerous victories, including the capture of Detroit after the American general there surrendered to a smaller force without a fight, and the occupation of Washington, D.C., which forced Madison to flee the city and watch as the White House was set on fire by British troops. The attack was in retaliation for a U.S. invasion of York, Upper Canada, now Toronto, Ontario, in which the U.S. forces twice occupied the city, burning the Parliament buildings of Upper Canada. The British also armed American Indians in the West, most notably followers of Tecumseh. Finally, the Indians were defeated, and a standoff was reached on the Canadian border. The Americans built warships on the Great Lakes faster than the British and defeated the British fleet to avert a major invasion of New York in 1814. At sea, the British blockaded the entire coastline, cutting off both foreign trade and domestic trade between ports. Economic hardship was severe in New England, but entrepreneurs built factories that soon became the basis of the Industrial Revolution in America. Madison faced formidable obstacles, a divided cabinet, a factious party, a recalcitrant Congress, obstructionist governors, and amazingly, incompetent generals, together with militia who refused to fight outside their states. Most serious was the lack of unified popular support. There were serious threats of disunion in New England, which engaged in massive smuggling to Canada and refused to provide financial support or soldiers. However, Andrew Jackson in the South and William Henry Harrison in the West destroyed the main Indian threats by 1813. After the apparent defeat of Napoleon in 1814, both the British and Americans were exhausted. The cause of the war had been forgotten. The Indian issue was resolved. The causes of the war had been forgotten. The Indian issue was resolved, and it was time for peace. New England Federalists, however, set up a defeatist Hartford Convention that discussed secession. The Treaty of Ghent ended the war in 1815. There were no territorial gains on either side, as both sides returned to status quo ante bellum, that is, the previous boundaries. The Battle of New Orleans, in which Andrew Jackson defeated the British regulars, was fought 15 days after the treaty was signed, but before the news of the signing reached New Orleans. With peace finally established, the U.S. was swept by a sense of euphoria and national achievement in finally securing solid independence from Britain. In Canada, the war and its conclusion represented a successful defense of the country and a defining era in the formation of an independent national identity. This, coupled with ongoing suspicion of a U.S. desire to again invade the country, would culminate in the creation of the Dominion of Canada in 1867. In the U.S., the Federalist Party collapsed and eventually disappeared from politics, as an era of good feeling emerged, with a much lower level of political fear and vituperation, although political contentions certainly continued. Post-war. Although Madison had accepted the necessity of a Hamiltonian national bank, an effective taxation system based on tariffs, a standing professional army, and a strong navy, he drew the line at internal improvements as advocated by his Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin. In his last act before leaving office, Madison vetoed on states' rights grounds a bill for internal improvements, including roads, bridges, and canals. Having considered the bill, I am constrained by the insuperable difficulty I feel in reconciling this bill with the Constitution of the United States. The legislative powers vested in Congress are specified in the Constitution, and it does not appear that the power proposed to be exercised by the bill is among the enumerated powers. Madison rejected the view of Congress that the general welfare provision of the taxing and spending clause justified the bill, stating, "Such a view of the Constitution would have the effect of giving to Congress a general power of legislation instead of the defined and limited one hitherto understood to belong to them, the terms common defense and general welfare, embracing every object and act within the purview of a legislative trust." Madison urged a variety of measures that he felt were best executed under the national authority, including the federal support for roads and canals that would bind more closely together the various parts of our extended Confederacy. Later life. When Madison left office in 1817, he retired to Montpelier, his tobacco plantation in Virginia, not far from Jefferson's Monticello. Madison was then 65 years old. Dolly, who had thought they would finally have a chance to travel to Paris, was 49. But as with both Washington and Jefferson, Madison left the presidency a poorer man than when he entered, due to the steady financial collapse of his plantation. Some historians speculate that his mounting debt was one of the chief reasons why he refused to allow his notes on the Constitution Convention, or its official records which he processed, to be published in his lifetime.
He knew the value of his notes and wanted them to bring money to his estate for Dolly's use as his plantation failed. He was hoping for $100,000 from the sale of his papers, of which the notes were the gem. Madison's financial troubles and deteriorating mental and physical health would continue to consume him. In his later years, Madison also became extremely concerned about his legacy. He took to modifying letters and other documents in his possessions, changing days and dates, adding and deleting words and sentences, and shifting characters. By the time he had reached his late 70s, this, quote, straightening out had become almost an obsession. This can be seen by his editing of a letter he had written to Jefferson criticizing Lafayette. Madison not only inked out original passages, but went so far as to imitate Jefferson's handwriting as well. In Madison's mind, this may have represented an effort to make himself clear, to justify his actions both to history and to himself. During the final 6 years of his life, amid a sea of personal financial troubles that were threatening to engulf him, at times mental agitation issued in physical collapse. For the better part of a year in 1831 and 1832, he was bedridden, if not silenced, literally sick with anxiety. He began to despair of his ability to make himself understood by his fellow citizens. In 1829, at the age of 78, Madison was chosen as representative to the Constitutional Convention in Richmond for the revising of the Virginia State Constitution. This was to be Madison's last appearance as a legislator and constitutional draftsman. The issue of greatest importance at this convention was appointment. The western districts of Virginia complained that they were underrepresented because the state constitution apportioned voting districts by population, and the count included slaves even though slaves could not vote. Westerners had few slaves, while the eastern planters had many, and thus the vote of a white easterner outweighed the vote of a white westerner. Madison, who in his prime was known as the great legislator, tried to effect a compromise, such as the 3/5 ratio for a slave then used by the U.S. Constitution, but to no avail. Eventually, the eastern planters prevailed. Slaves would continue to be counted toward their masters' districts. Madison was crushed at the failure of Virginians to resolve the issue more equably. The convention of 1829, we might say, pushed Madison steadily to the brink of self-delusion, if not despair. The dilemma of slavery undid him. Although his health had now almost failed, he managed to produce several memoranda on political subjects, including an essay against the appointment of chaplains for Congress and the armed forces, on the grounds that this produced religious exclusion, but not political harmony. Madison lived on until 1836, increasingly ignored by the new leaders of the American polity. He died at Montpelier on June 28th, the last remaining signatory of the United States Constitution. He's buried in the Madison Family Cemetery at Montpelier. Today, Montpelier is open to visitors. As historian Gary Willis wrote, "Madison's claim on our admiration does not rest on a perfect consistency, any more than it rests on his presidency. He has other virtues. As a framer and defender of the Constitution, he had no peer. The finest part of Madison's performance as president was his concern for the preserving of the Constitution. No man could do everything for the country, not even Washington. Madison did more than most, and he did some things better than any. That was quite enough."
Legacy. As historian Gary Willis wrote, "Madison's claim on our admiration does not rest on a perfect consistency any more than it rests on his presidency. He has other virtues. As a framer and defender of the Constitution, he had no peer. The finest part of Madison's performance as president was his concern for the preserving of the Constitution. No man could do everything for the country, not even Washington. Madison did more than most, and did some things better than any. That was quite enough." Many counties, several towns, cities such as Madison, Wisconsin, educational institutions, a mountain range, and a river are named after Madison.
the James Madison College of Public Policy at Michigan State University, James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Its athletic teams are called the James Madison Dukes. The James Madison Institute was named in honor of his contributions to the Constitution. The Madison Range was named in honor of the future president, then U.S. Secretary of State, by Meriwether Lewis, as the Lewis and Clark expedition traveled through Montana in 1805. The Madison River in southwestern Montana, named in 1805 by Lewis and Clark. Two U.S. Navy ships have been named USS James Madison and three USS Madison. Madison's portrait was on the U.S. $5,000 bill.
This concludes the article. This recording is distributed under the terms of the GNU. Free documentation license available at http://www.gnu.org.